don't worry. Nothing ex-certificate about this story. Oh, no. And it's less about a letter, more about a noise.
Ooh.
Exactly. But is that oh noise a word, a sound, or just a kind of all-purpose filler? I mean, this wouldn't work properly without O.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful...
Nor would this.
Oh, Johnny, how you can love. Oh, Johnny, oh...
But O has more to do than play a spare syllable to secure scanning for a silly song. It's the sound of surprise, irritation, or even a big build-up. It can mean so much and virtually nothing. Zero. But give it a bit of context.
We were out with a lady last night, sir. Oh, did she want it, sir? Oh, did she, sir? Oh, 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 suit you, sir? Oh.
No, I'm gay.
And it can go a long way. Oh, yes. Consider it as a vowel sound for a moment.
Hey, man, I'm too poop to pop, and I ain't lying. I'm too poop to pop.
And it also helps to create some of our favourite onomatopoeia.
You know, you keep your lips closed, you build the pressure up behind them, then you open your lips and you release the pressure.
Richard Ogden is a reader in phonetics and linguistics at the University of York.
That's what happens when you burst a balloon or when a champagne cork comes out. So the puh there is iconic of a real world event. And then if you think of the vowel that's in there, it's pop, not pip, or pap. That's interesting too, because oh has behind it a bigger, more echoey cavity than an I, which has got a little cavity behind it. And that also seems to me to be right for the kinds of things that go pop.
Let's consider for a moment the popularity of the word pop. Pop music, pop up, in or out, pop art. Because our story of O is also because O is for onomatopoeia. Oh, yes. Pop art has borrowed heavily from onomatopoeia. I'm thinking zap, pow, kaplunk in the work of Roy Lichtenstein. So pop is a sound, or our approximation of it. And at the same time, pop is a proper word that can stand up for itself in a dictionary or a game of Scrabble. But what is onomatopoeia? And how and where does it fit in with these involuntary sounds we make? Well, Richard Ogden has made this a study.
I would put onomatopoeia on a scale. So at one end of the scale, I would put things that I would call response cries. So those would be things like oops or brrr when you're really cold or phew when you're relieved. So the most natural, spontaneous blurting out of things. At the other end of the scale, I would put proper words, like the kinds of things that you can find in a dictionary, because for words, the relationship between the form and the meaning is really arbitrary. So if I say something like dog, there's nothing about the sounds in the word dog that tell you what the word dog should mean. It's a social convention. And then in between those two things, there's other sorts of phenomena, and I think onomatopoeic words are one of them. So words like zap or sizzle, those are words that use the sounds of English to represent the things that those words describe. And then a little bit further towards the response cries end, I would put things like response tokens like oh or wow, which I don't think are onomatopoeic because they don't reflect any real world event, but they're not words in the same way that a word like dog or eat is, because you can't put it in a sentence in the same way. So I would see this all as a continuum, with very linguistic things at one end and very unlinguistic things at the other end.
So let's stay at the allegedly unlinguistic end, where noises like O and many others can be found.
So there's the, you're right? And then, that's like a yeah, but it's
This is comedian Spencer Jones, a man who communicates almost entirely with a non-verbal repertoire of quite batty noises.
The non verbal stuff came about from not writing scripts, but also wanting the audience to kind of come along for the ride. So those first noises were me saying hello, but not committing to saying hello. Me saying all right, but not committing to saying all right. So, and you just sort of look around the room. And once you'd done that, you could then move on to the next thing, which might be, oh, God. As if to say, check out this, yeah, I think you all know what I'm talking about. And then you might point at something, but you then ask if it's okay. You want to, yeah, and you're pointing, you're looking, you're just double-checking, yeah, they're right with it. All right, yeah, all right. It was the need to not speak, like, please don't speak. Try and make something different. And so as a result, these kind of weird noises have started coming out.
Spencer's sounds are not strictly onomatopoeia in the Richard Ogden sense, because he doesn't use them to mimic actual real-world events. They're more like vocal shrugs than actual phrases. But Spencer's noises only really work if you add the visual element, which we can't hear. Non-verbal communication fills in, gives the grammar, the structure, if you like. But the audience still has to make an imaginative leap to understand his on-stage language. And Spencer's training in mime helps with that. But less is more. And that, of course, is the point.
Yeah, you're giving less away. There's a lot more magic in the audience's head. Like, if I go, have a look at this. That's a southern voice. It's a man's voice. That's got baggage, if you like, you know? Whereas if I raise my eyebrows and go, then there's a bit more magic in it. I think that's one of the key things about clowning I learned was the magic's in the audience's head. So the less you do, the more they make up in their own head about you. You know, and a man with his hands on his hips looking at somebody else doing something, going, that says lots more than a bloke going, look at him, he's not doing that right. It's much funnier, isn't it? It's economical.
So, whether they're accompanied by visuals or not, these human noises, fillers, interjections, whatever you want to call them, Flickwort in German, they have important roles to play. If you had to explain the distinction between noise made by a human and word to the proverbial alien, you'd have a very hard task, wouldn't you? Yuck. I can't eat that. Yum. I can eat that. Wow, that is one Grand Canyon. Splat! I've thrown it against the wall. Zap! The alien has become impatient with my explanation and fired a weapon at me. With me is a world expert in a very specialised lexicon of onomatopoeia, sounds and sound effects, graphic novelist and Watchmen artist Dave Gibbons. Dave, you've created and translated sound for 2000 AD and the Doctor Who comics, loads more. Is the sound effects element something you enjoy?
Yeah, I think in a certain kind of comic, it's very important. You know, comics are essentially the kind of marriage of words and pictures, and sound effects are sort of taking the word into the picture and making it part of the picture and using it as a graphic effect above and beyond the actual letters it contains. But I think, you know, one of the things with designing sound effects is, I don't know if you've ever come across this thing where certain shapes look like they're kind of blurpy. Booba is the word. Yes. And that's a very rounded, splatty kind of shape. And kicky is a very pointed shape. And when you're doing your sound effects, if you bear things like that in mind, you can make the word boom even more explosive by having it kind of swelling towards the middle and having it cracking slightly as it does expand. Oh.
So there's a sort of rebus element. It's a visual onomatopoeia as well as a sound one.
Yes, that's right. And, of course, you also get examples in comics of it working the other way, where you actually take a picture and put it into the thought balloon to express a thought.
Yes, and then there are very sort of fizzling things you can do as well, aren't there? It's a whole range of extra tools that you have that other writers don't have. Mm. And do you feel there's a need to be original? Do you try and make up new zoinks and bloomps and fiff and vroom and other such things, or are you happy to stay in the sort of accepted world?
No, because I think, you know, the sound effect is capable of great subtlety and should be considered very thoroughly. For instance, whilst researching this, I came across something which is the sound of an ambient liquid. Now, that could be bloop, B-L-O-O-P, bloop.
Yeah, bloop, yes.
Or it could be blorp. which is still an ambient liquid, but it's a slightly more viscous.
It is, isn't it? You can actually see the little bubble arising from a blorp that is different from a bloop. Mm. That's brilliant. Yeah.
And, of course, it could just be a blop, which is, you know, so so even within that narrow range, you know, there's a lot of subtlety.
Well, of course, children do respond wonderfully to onomatopoeia because they can instantly see the connection between the sound of the word and the experience that it's defining or describing.
Yeah, and I mean, they're generally short words, and they kind of have a nice mixture of consonants and vowels, and they're fun to say, really. I mean, I really enjoyed saying bloop, blorp, blop. You know, I mean, it's just a nice exercise of the speaking equipment.
And you talked about the spiky words and the boomy words. Do you remember Graham Chapman in The Pythons doing that wonderful sketch where he plays some sort of English squire in tweeds, and he says, I like that, it's a woody word. That's a woody word. And other words are tinny words. And I remember at school the next day, we were all just going through saying, oh, it's a woody word. And the beauty of all this, you know, is that it awakens one's awareness of the splendour of one's tongue hitting the back of one's teeth and one's lips coming forwards to make a little explosion and do that thing we call making a sound, speaking.
In a way, it's a caricature, I think. In a way that many comic drawings are caricatures, maybe the sounds that you get in comics are caricatures of sound.
I know turkey. Gobble, gobble, gobble. Cockerel. Cock-a-doodle-doo. My favourite one is pig.
Onomatopoeia has a key role to play in speech development.
My name's Catherine Lang and I'm a postdoctoral research associate at Duke University. When you think about the sounds that babies make early on, before they're actually producing words, they tend to be mama, dada, baba, and these are what we call reduplicated words. And onomatopoeia have a lot of reduplication. So if a baby's already saying ma, 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 then saying a word such as meow isn't so different from the babble that they've been producing as babies. And the same goes for woof, woof and ba, ba for a sheep. There is also that feature that makes them really interesting for babies who are trying to speak but are finding it very difficult.
In her study of early child language development, Catherine Lang noticed that babies and small children were producing lots of onomatopoeia in their early words, generally between 20 to 30% in Western cultures. So why is this?
The question has been about whether or not they're easier to learn because the sound and the meaning are really close together. So the word dog and its meaning are quite arbitrary, whereas the word woof-woof is very closely linked to the meaning, the sound that a dog makes. So it's been proposed that infants might actually find these words much easier to learn. And while this might be the case, there are also lots of other interesting features of onomatopoeia that might make them more appealing to babies and to young infants when they first start to speak. When we use onomatopoeia, we often use sound effects. So we might produce woof woof as woof woof. We might say meow as meow. And this is more interesting to young babies, that these words stand out more from the vocabulary.
Babymatopoeia is possibly the purest, gentlest kind of sound symbolism. But simply, a cuckoo helpfully names itself with its call. Less so this.
Of course, explosions don't sound like bang, but bang does sound like an explosion. The word bang also starts with a plosive. It starts with something that has pressure building up behind a closure in the vocal tract, and then you release it. The thing that's maybe a bit unexpected is that the ang at the end is a bit resonant, and that goes a bit better with, let's say, ding or dong for a bell, which has got the same sort of thing, starting off with this rapid onset to the sound where you strike the bell, and then after you've struck the bell, if it's a good one, it resonates for a while, and so do ding and dong. But so does bang, and maybe that reflects the fact that after an explosion there's usually some chaos and there's some time where there's debris falling and things like that. With my high starch collar and my high top shoes.
But
and my
hair- bang, bong, ding, and yes, dong, and other similar onomatopoeia also have a metaphorical life of their own, again, based on human noises of the most involuntary sort. Exaggerated imaginary human noises that reference cardiological disorder brought on by infatuation. Your heart might quicken at the chance meeting of a loved one on a trolley bus. But songwriting convention has hyperbolized this into an orchestra of sound symbolism.
Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Sing, sing, sing went my heartstrings.
For the moment I saw my face.
All those plosives, fricatives, resonances so common in Anglo-Saxon onomatopoeia, of course, appeal to children learning how language works because they sound so extraordinary alongside the usual boring drivel of adult babble. Blah, 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 Martha and Jude coming for dinner on Friday, blah, 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 postmodern treatise on consumer capitalism, blah, 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 neoliberal, blah, 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 blah. Much more fun to be found, for example, in fizz-squiggling, whiz-popping and splash-winkling that playfully suggest onomatopoeia but don't always have a definition.
Words, said the BFG, is, oh, such a twitch-tickling problem to me all my life. So you must simply try to be patient and stop squibbling. As I'm telling you before, I know exactly what words I'm wanting to say, but somehow or other, they is always getting squiffed-squiddled around.
Roald Dahl was the great gobble-funker of words, and his onomatopoeia conventions were so swashbuckling that there's now an actual dictionary of his creations.
I'm Dr. Susan Rennie, chief editor of the Oxford Roald Dahl Dictionary. He intuitively understood, I think, kind of sounds that children like to say and that are going to be fun, so he used a lot of sounds like iffle and iddle and oddle, fizz-wiggler, whiff-swiddle. I mean, you can hear all those clusters of sounds that he loved playing with, till he gets one that he just knows is going to create the greatest giggle effect, if you like. So just working down the list, he has things like biz-fizz, buzz-fuzz, starts with squiggling, but that's too normal, so he changes it to squibbling, squinkling, squackling, scumping, squiddling, slunging. You can almost hear him giggling internally as he's writing these down, and he knew that these would appeal to children.
I love the thought of Roald Dahl giggling to himself. That's another one, giggle, as he scribbled, there's another, and cross-pollinated sound words, because that's what he was doing, cross-pollination. A veritable Gregor Mendel in his laboratory, but with whizzing, popping, squiggling, fizzing Anglo-Saxon word parts instead of peas.
One of the strange things about onomatopoeia, which is the way that we try and represent the sounds of the natural world and the sounds of natural body sounds as well, is that the human vocal cords are not great at representing other natural sounds in the world. So we have to come up with as close a representation as we can. But Dahl does pretty well in some words. I mean, whiz-popping, of course, is his famous word for breaking wind, which is quite a clever creation, actually. I mean, whiz-pop, it mixes that first sound, which we call a fricative sound, whiz, which has a lot of air in it. At least if you have an accent like mine, it has a fricative sound, so whiz pop. And then it's got that plosive at the end, so it imitates the sound of something that's got an explosion and a lot of air, which, without being indelicate about it, that's exactly what whiz popping is.
Flatulence, let's be grown up and give it its proper name, is an interesting testbed on which to pursue onomatopoeia theory. As a phenomenon, the fart is as universal as the sneeze. So why does the colloquial onomatopoeic word for it differ from country to country?
In Icelandic, this is a favourite sound of mine, a fart goes prump. In French, it goes prot. And in Korean, this is the same sound as they use for bees, which is interesting, is boong. I think it might be the drawn-out O again, like boong for imitating a fart.
So fascinated was he by the ununiversal nature of the prump or the boom. Illustrator James Chapman created an entire book of onomatopoeia called How to Sneeze in Japanese. It could also have been called How to Fart in Turkish, to which the answer is pert.
A friend of mine was teaching English in South Korea and he told me that all these children said, dogs go mung, 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 mung. And I thought that was very strange. as I was brought up on woof woof, woof woof. And looking into it, they're both quite bad at describing what sounds a dog makes, but they're both, they're an attempt at it. And that's basically the whole idea of onomatopoeia, is just an attempt to recreate a sound that we have really no way of making or writing down.
Let's try foreign heartbeats, for example.
Heartbeats are, in English, I think in the medical profession, lub-dub, lub-dub. In Japanese, it's doki, 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 doki. And Danish, it's dunk, dunk. And Spanish, boom, boom. But the interesting one to me was Indonesian, where it goes dag, dig, dug, dag, dig, dug, dag, dig, dug. So you end up with threefold sound repeated through the heart.
Surely you're gobble-funking me. The Indonesians get an extra heartbeat for free. Of course, it's a convention in English-language comics that the sound of sleeping and snoring can be reduced to a single letter Z repeated. But while we zzz as we sleep, in France it's more like this.
When they breathe in, they go ron, and then they breathe out, they go psh. So they go ron, psh, ron, psh. But Indonesian, there's just a breathe in and then grook, which is G-R, series of O's and a series of K's. And Korean is dururong, dururong. My favourite probably is the German sound of eating, which is mampf, which sounds like a big bite out of, like a sudden bite out of nowhere, mampf. Like someone was stealing your chips. They'd just say mampf and they'd be gone.
But why do onomatopoeia appear to be so different around the world? Catherine Lang again.
I would argue that actually these words aren't quite so different as we might think. When we think about the example of dog, well, German and Swedish, who use vv for their dog sound, don't actually have the w sound in their language. So they're taking the sounds of their language and adapting the sound that they hear of a dog to match the sounds of their own language. And the same goes for Spanish. There's no w or no v in Spanish. So their dog says guau guau. So I don't actually think that these words are quite so different across languages as we might first believe.
What about the famous Japanese onomatopoeia? Japanese has more than three times as many onomatopoeic expressions as English and uses them to express a huge range of experiences, including touches, tastes and sights, as well as audible noises.
Japanese is often considered in the study of onomatopoeia because it is famous for having lots and lots and lots of what we think of as onomatopoeic words. But these actually aren't onomatopoeia in the way that we as English speakers might know them. And they have their own label called mimetic words. So, for example, you might express a tactile sensation caused by a slimy object using the word nuru nuru, which to a Japanese speaker would seem iconic or onomatopoeic. And in mimetic words, the expression is actually part of the phonetic signal. So different consonants are used to express different ideas. For example, the word goro goro represents the movement of a heavy object. But the word koro koro represents the movement of a light object. So you can manipulate what you're trying to express by changing the consonant.
I'm trying to think of an English equivalent to goro goro. Blooming heck, this is heavy. Mm-hmm. But goro goro can be used to express all sorts of other things too. Rumbling noises like thunder, for example. The discomfort caused by a lump. Things strewn about in abundance, or also being in a state of complete idleness or inertia, goro goro. Dave Gibbons. I wondered about a whole other universe of comic art, and that's manga in the Japanese. Mm. Did they use these sort of phatic sounds, these mimetic noises as well?
They do indeed have huge sound effects plastered all over them. The fact that they are in Japanese means that, that other than their shape, I don't get a lot from them. But I think, again, as I said, that thing of shape, you know, it gives a kind of graphic contrast to the page, and it gives an emphasis to things, and you almost don't have to know the word. As part of my research for this, Stephen, I've actually got a book called Kaboom, which is a dictionary of comic book words, symbols and onomatopoeia. The Thesaurus of Champions, which isn't easy to say. And this is like 150 pages of Boing smack, boink, bock, bomb, 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 bop, bomberon, bomb, kabom, bong, bonk, bop, bosh. It just goes on and on and on and on and on.
And of course, I suppose it's important that they're not words that have a meaning, that they are purely for their sound contribution.
Yes, I mean, I'm tempted to mention the sound that Captain America's shield makes when it hits a wrongdoer.
Yeah.
I do have an American comic, and as you know, the American language and the English language are not really much the same. And in this particular Captain America comic from the 60s, as his metal shield thwacks into the evildoer, it makes the sound wank.
There you go.
Which was never how I imagined it, but apparently, if you're an innocent American comic book writer, that is the noise you hear in your head.
It suggests the movement through the air, the wuh, and then the metallic clank offers the second half. So it's quite...
Yeah.
Well observed.
It is.
There's energy to these words, usually, isn't there? Do you ever do a sort of soft sound, like a susurration of silks, you know, a frou-frou of dresses?
well, you know, the French have rather more attractive sound effects. They have words like plaf.
Oh, what is
plaf? Is nice. P-L-A-F.
Plaf.
That's sort of, I think that's being hit with a soft satin cushion is a plaf.
Oh, lovely. Very French.
And of course, if someone, for instance, is walking along in the rain, you know, there might be a very small sound effect by their feet, which is splash, splish, splash, splish.
Oh, yes.
So you can make a quiet noise very small. You know, that's really how you do it.
Yes, and the French do love their, you know, you see their sort of biscuits. C'est cric, c'est crac, c'est cracotte. You know, that sort of thing. They love all that.
I'll just write that down. That might come in handy.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of the conversation now. And, just searching in life for... can't think of anything else. Is that enough? Yeah.
No, I can't think of anything else either. Oh, wait a minute. We started by calling this the story of O, with that suspenseful... Ooh. And looking back at the script, I see an elephant was promised. And we missed out the Scottish word for flatulence, which is shared by someone we're all familiar with. Now the elephant popped a chunk and said goodbye to the circus. All she went with a chomity chunk.